You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, October 23rd, 2017. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Monday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Marshall Steinbaum, research director and fellow at the Roosevelt Institute on the tax debate we need. Hint, it's not about the deficit. Bill O'Reilly is doubling down, even though it's come out that there was over a $30 million settlement because of his behavior at Fox. Soldier's widow, soldier of Lieutenant Johnson, says that Trump struggled to remember his name the whole time. Fake news. Even as Trump promises to pay the legal bills of any aides that might find themselves in trouble. Another thing that I wouldn't exactly take his word for. And the U.S. is preparing to put its nuclear bombs back on a 24-hour alert, which they have not been since the Cold War. Great. Tillerson and Mattis to testify in a closed hearing on reauthorization of the AUMF. The deaths in Niger have somewhat intruded back into public consciousness, slightly, that we're still fighting a global war based off of a rapidly aging defense authorization. And is the Mueller investigation now putting a Democratic lobbying supergroup in its crosshairs as part of an investigation of Paul Manafort? It's the swamp, folks. The swamp, and we can find out, did Lion Ted's dad play a role in the assassination of JFK? Donald Trump's releasing, apparently.
Raphael, what have you been doing?
Raphael. Trump enlists family, cabinet, and Congress in addressing the opioid crisis. And the EPA backs down on a biofuels program. And Catalonia resists new pressure from Spain's prime minister as that situation continues to intensify. Rajoy promising to get rid of regional autonomy there. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Let's start out of the gate with a bit of sound. This is John McCain. I always usually give a caveat. I'm very hard on John McCain, and I think we need to be hard on John McCain for a variety of reasons, from his warmongering to Sarah Palin to his daughter. But that being said, this was a good shot he gave here against Donald Trump, and I say the more of this, the better. Why not? As long as it doesn't allow us to glorify George Bush's and John McCain's, they're awful. Or Bob Corker, for that matter. But in this context, to undermine Trump and to have a little bit of internal Republican heat, great. Go for it.
Mass arrests, demonstrations, Chicago, that all of us can look back and see on C-SPAN. But it was a tumultuous time, and most of it was bred by the conflict. And one aspect of the conflict, by the way, that I will never, ever countenance is that we drafted the lowest income level of America, and the highest income level found a doctor that would say that they had a bone spur. That is wrong. That is wrong. If we're going to ask every American to serve, every American should serve.
A bone spur. What trust fund baby could John McCain be referencing there? I believe that a certain bloated narcissist. Wasn't that the way he got out of Vietnam? Bone spur?
That's correct.
Bone spur. So effective shade there from Senator McCain. And as always, we wish him well in his medical. He's facing something. It's really horrible. Like, my understanding is that there's
not a good prognosis.
There's not a way out of that, really, is my understanding. So that's terrible.
Ted Kennedy had the same.
That was the same. Oh, really? I didn't realize that. Yeah, no, that's really bad. And it's cool that he's going down swinging. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post the job to find the best candidates? We were just hiring, and we found Brendan Patrick. Brendan Patrick O'Malley O'Finnegan, for the ZipRecruiter. He was sitting at home watching Fox News clips, not knowing where to feed him to. He didn't know where to go. And now here he is in our office.
Folks, ZipRecruiter does not include an Irish need not apply.
What if hiring could be easier, more streamlined, and less time-consuming? So even when you're busy, you could still find the smart way to go about your hire. If you're hiring, and you know the quality hires keep your business moving forward, you also know it can take a lot of time to find the right candidate for the job. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to up to over 100 webs, over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. Then ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting so you can receive the best possible matches, like Brendan. Brendan was there, and Brendan was like, what did Steve Ducey's son was sent to Aruba? And he asked somebody a question, and I have a time code for this, but I don't have a job. Ding! Majority Report. Boom. And now he's here making this show better and better. That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidate finding you. It finds them. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter can get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. Boom. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Simply screen, rate, and manage candidate all with one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And one time to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. And you know what, folks? Great candidates are not the only things that we're looking for in our lives. We're all looking for something. For some, it's love. For some, it's a sense of purpose. For others, it's unforgettable experiences. But for most, it's your keys. Well, with Tracker Pixel, you'll never worry about losing your things again. 8 years ago, Tracker, that's T-R-A-C-K, capital R, changed everything when they released their first tracking device. Now they've done it again with the all new Tracker Pixel. Tracker Pixel is the lightest Bluetooth tracking device in the market. Place Tracker Pixel on whatever you tend to lose, keys, wallets, even your cat. Then when you misplace an item that has a Tracker Pixel attached, use your smartphone and a 90 decibel alert will help find it in seconds. It has powerful LED lights so you can find things in the dark. It will help you find your phone even if it's on silent. Better yet, because Tracker is used as part of the largest crowd locate network in the world, you can locate items from miles away. And thanks to Tracker's 30-day money-back guarantee, you truly have nothing to lose. Go to tracker.com/majority to get 20% off of any order. That's tracker.com/majority for 20% off. tracker.com/majority. Have you guys ever walked by a newsstand and seen a stunning magazine that makes you want to stop and peek inside or read a headline cover that makes you need to know more?
Three different times.
Next time you do, remember Texture. With the Texture app, not only do you get a peek, you get the whole magazine plus unlimited access to over 200 premium titles like Time, The Atlantic, The New Yorker, and Wired. And right now you can get Texture for free. Just imagine having your favorite magazines and their back issues anytime, anywhere. To start your texture free trial, go to texture.com/majority. If you choose to continue, podcast listeners will get Texture for just $9.99 a month. That's over 30% off their listed price. They're also a great gift options for available for the holidays. Go to texture.com/majority to start your free trial today. That's texture.com/majority. Texture.com/majority. So tomorrow on the Michael Brooks Show, Woz Nilambre, who is launching his own podcast now. It's finally been announced. He's back, relaunched in L.A. The Basketball Friends is the relaunch version of True Hoop. And then his own show, which is Woz Speaks, which I really like because it's like Muhammad Speaks, the Nation of Islam newspaper. So, and I think it looks like I'll probably be a regular on that show as well. So Woz is going to come in. We have a whole bunch of things to talk about. And opening commentary.
Is Woz in studio?
No, Woz is going to be in L.A.
Oh, okay.
It's going to be our first call.
Gotcha.
But it's tough. We were joking at Woz's going away party. We were both joking about our different shower crying techniques that we're going to have yeah. when we're far away from each other. And then Hunter Matz, who co-hosts the Mixed Mental Martial Arts podcast and is a science writer, we're going to talk about IQ mythology and debunk Charles Murray. All that and much, much more. And if you're not a patron of the Michael Brooks Show yet, you just missed the seventh illicit history, which is on Iran's justified paranoia and the ideological and historical origins of the Islamic Republic and all the way up to the Iran nuclear deal with the P5+1. We're actually today, if you're a subscriber on iTunes, the Michael Brooks Show, we're going to be releasing one of our post-game shows we did with Bree, Joy Gray, which was really funny. And you should check it out.
Just to give you a taste.
Give me a little bit of a taste. Most of our stuff, though, we're our 742 patrons, who are the best people in the world, they get an unbelievable... Like, we're very lot. We're at least 3, maybe even 4 to 1 in terms of patrons to public content. So if you haven't checked it out yet, please do. Really honored by all the positive feedback, and it's a very different show than MR, but very complimentary. So definitely check it out. We will be right back with Marshall Steinbaum from the Roosevelt Institute. We're going to be talking about how to talk about taxes. From them I play bad young, I them a bad biters. Hypocritical to sideless. We call them modern day Judas. The spreaders of rumors. Oh, them a bad biters. Hypocritical to sideless. We call them modern day Judas. Spreaders of rumors. Hey, hey, so why should I be afraid of you? When you bleed just like I do, the more you try fight, judge a light keeps shining too. So I've got no time for you, cause in my view you wanna step in on my shoe. You wish you never leave a loo and feel so damn confused. How every day you wake you ache because you know you're fake, and every step you take I bring you closer to your grave. But I am like a column when I easily shake. Me certain say I feel me none of who can't take. We guided by the monster defender of the faith. Yes. Ordained to be great, oh them a bad biters. Hypocritical to sideless. We call them modern day Judas. The spreaders of rumors. Oh them a bad biters. Hypocritical to sideless. We call them modern day Judas. Spreaders of rumors. But your teeth and tongue gonna let you down. Reward for your words shall be profound. Oh, screw all you want, but go loo and drown. Me slew you like Goliath with a stone from a crown. Not even the dog that be set on the wall of Babylon shall escape in these times. So word to the wise, choose the right side. And down to be hindered by your foolish pride. I said no weapon formed against I and I shall prosper, prosper. So tell me something. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks joining us now is Marshall Steinbaum. He's a research director and fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. Marshall, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Marshall, let's start at the basics. You have a really good piece in the Jacobin, The Tax Debate We Need. What is the purpose of modern Republican tax policy? And I guess let's just take it back to the Reagan era.
My interpretation of what the Republicans and the broad conservative movement have been up to in tax policy over the last 40 or so years has basically been to reconcentrate power in the hands of the wealthy. That is to say, the owners and executives of major corporations and their heirs, and anyone who exerts power over the economy and the other stakeholders in the corporations that they own and run. I think basically what happened was that in the New Deal and in the Progressive Era, their power was tamed by many policies, but especially by progressive taxation, because as I explained in that piece, if you crank up progressive taxes high enough, you basically make it de facto illegal to be rich. And once it's de facto illegal to be rich, that weakens the bargaining power of the richest stakeholders in society. And so what happened was the United States adopted a strong progressive tax regime, and that had a profound impact on the distribution of power in the economy. It was one that certainly Franklin Roosevelt's political enemies felt acutely and hated him for. And I think that after the New Deal, after the Roosevelt presidency was over, they set about a political and ideological project to restore the world that they had lived in, one in which they exercised more power and one in which progressive taxes were as low as they had been.
Yeah, so we're going to get to that because I think it's important to describe the sort of the ideological scam that goes along with this, just a sort of raw reassertion of elite power with regards to the economy. But elaborate, I mean, when you talk about not allowing people to be rich, and this actually does feed into the mythology, there is a notion that, you know, even amongst the kind of technocratic center, and, you know, in the 90s, the kind of, I mean, the third way sort of politicians that sought to carve out some slight sort of softening of basically extreme income inequality and pretty rapid globalization, but kind of have a couple of areas of slight taxation for wealthy people and slight investments in public services, whether we're talking about Bill Clinton in the United States. And I want to use this quote, even though it's in a British context, but Peter Mandelson, who was an advisor to Tony Blair, he actually said, specifically, he said, we're intensely relaxed about people getting, you know, extremely wealthy, I think was the quote, to paraphrase. So what was it that sort of that Roosevelt and that line of politics understood that in order to have actually some of the sort of genuine open democracy that everybody valorizes in their, you know, the kind of talk about free speech and having a rational open square and all of the rest of it, that you can't actually credibly make the case that you're having that unless you have a radically evened playing field and massive redistribution of resources. Because if you don't, then all the rest of that is just going to be a smokescreen for like the raw assertion of power. And so what was it that made the New Dealers and Roosevelt get that basic insight that we seem like we've been missing ever since, or at least since the 60s?
I think that's an incredibly revealing quote from Mandelson, and I think it gets right down to the enormous ideological difference between Roosevelt and the political movement that he represented and the sort of centrist third way that Mandelson represents, and that is quite influential here as well as in the UK. And that is to say, why are rich people rich, and by extension, why are poor people poor? The Roosevelt view, the progressive view, the populist view that grew out of the Gilded Age was that by and large it was because they exploited society to their own benefit, or they had inherited from parents who had done that. And the Mandelson view, on the other hand, I think reflects the kind of technocratic ideology of the current age, which is to say that essentially, the economy is a meritocracy. If you're rich, it's because you came up with a brilliant idea or were such a assiduous manager that you were able to contribute and thus were compensated for that enormous contribution to society. And you can see that kind of meritocratic view of how wealth and income should be allocated in the economy would, I would say, enable a slippery slope back from kind of the, you could say, the technocratic elite centrism that was inaugurated by the Roosevelt age and the New Deal back towards the retrograde ideology of the Gilded Age. That is to say, once we're not going to question anymore why rich people are rich because we assume that it's due to their mastery of the economy to the public benefit, then you excuse one after another of the actions and the exploitations that rich people use to get to where they are and remain there.
So then let's go to the backlash and the sort of counter narrative that starts, you know, it starts to maybe get really put into practice in the 80s with Reagan, but already in the 70s, you're seeing at least a sort of neoliberal turn in the Democratic side and actually an interesting kind of split that Matt Stoller writes about of a kind of even these 70s sort of liberals coming out of the 60s with this intense concern, rightly, about things like the military-industrial complex and rightly a much greater understanding of the things of the, you know, the emancipatory movements of social justice, but actually a lot more credulousness about concentrated economic power and inequality in the corporate sector. How does this... Let's first start talking about it first from an ideological perspective, and then we'll get into just the kind of raw money of it. What's the counter narrative that starts being built to return us to a gilded age, which is essentially what Republican tax policy is?
So I think you can't tell the story without starting with the civil rights movement, but especially with the backlash to the civil rights movement, because what the civil rights movement was, in my interpretation, was the extension of the quasi-social democratic policies of the New Deal to include everyone regardless of race. Right. So what we got out of the New Deal itself in the 30s was a social democratic state, an edifice that served almost exclusively white people. Right. And starting in the 40s, and then especially through Brown v. Board of Ed, and then the what we think of as the high civil rights movement in the early 60s, that grand edifice of the state that had been erected on to the benefit of white people in the 30s was gradually expanded to include everyone, regardless of race.
At least that was the shifting intention of activists and some policymakers to some degree. I mean, there's still a lot of work to be done, but contradictions. But at the same time, there was a sense that we're shifting.
In economic terms, it's not controversial in the sense that things like the black-white employment gap and the black-white earnings gap had been basically stagnant from the end of Reconstruction through the 40s, very much including the Progressive Era and the New Deal. That is to say, they had not had a discernible impact on racial economic gaps. Starting in the 40s, in my view, the integration of the military-industrial complex and then the military itself were absolutely crucial elements of this, that you start to see those gaps closing up through the late 70s, at which point they stopped closing. What I think the ideological transformation that you were referring to grew out of the backlash to that racial egalitarianism. That is to say, it was enormously threatening to the coalition, what might be called the New Deal Civil Rights Coalition, where it created cleavages within different subsets of that coalition. And I think the right was well positioned to exploit those cleavages. I mean, certainly Richard Nixon was the master of that. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, in the controversy over school busing, for example, as creating great doubt about the efficacy of the New Deal bureaucratic administrative state that is by design egalitarian, comes to be seen as a sort of oppressive force, even when, you know, I think a more enlightened latter day interpretation of it would be as a liberating force. But
of course,
view of racial the racial hierarchy is that it is zero sum, and that creates the ingredients for a backlash. And I think this was something that the right was well able to take advantage of. Interestingly, I don't think it was really, I think part of the right's own mythology of how they took advantage of this is that they sort of convinced the public that the New Deal had to be rolled back, and that everyone became, you know, the sort of broad swath of the population became followers of Ayn Rand. And that is definitely not true. I think where their success was in convincing the political system that the people, that their constituents, that the electorate had turned against the New Deal and its egalitarian aims, rather than the reality of that being done. So if you look at, for instance,
go ahead.
So there's interesting work on kind of the mythology of the tax revolt in California. How that was, you know, this what became Prop 13 was kind of the culmination of a you know, decade long maybe series of tax revolts that happened on the local level, that definitely had a racial aspect to them, in the sense that people, mostly white homeowners, were saying, you know, my property taxes are too high, and look, it's funding this kind of out of control liberal do-gooder integrationist regime in public education that I want no part of. So there was definitely that to it, but the way it became interpreted in Washington was as a rejection of progressive taxation altogether, which is actually diametrically the opposite of true. I think a better summary of what the ideology of the tax revolt was my prop, that is me, middle-class white person's tax, property taxes are too high. Instead, the rich people should be paying for this. That got reinterpreted in D.C. as a rejection of progressive taxation and the entirety of the sort of over-aggressive tax and spend
federal
government.
Well, was it, though? I mean, because that's – the Nixon administration is really interesting with regards to this, because there's kind of three different things happening in some respects. I mean, there's this effort in the 60s to – as you say, I mean, first the, you know, overturn American apartheid and Jim Crow, and then at the same time also say, if we're going to have some type of, you know, modest social democracy, the delivery has to be for everyone. And so the right sees an opportunity to use racial division to reclaim, traditional Democratic voters in the New Deal coalition. So people like Kevin Phillips, who was a, you know, an intellectual architect of Nixonism, they're talking about, you know, a coalition of, you know, Southern voters, and they would call them Northern ethnics, like Italian, Irish type of thing, and using a lot of signifiers like law and order, silent majority, that type of thing. Now, the Nixon administration is interesting in that regard, because, I mean, as everybody kind of knows, being a cliche at this point, and in some ways it was like the sort of domestically, like kind of the last liberal president in some ways, that, you know, we're all Keynesian now, the creation of the EPA, you know, different social investments that that administration engaged in. And then there's another track of, you know, the Koch brothers and other, you know, sort of donor-based people dumping money into creating a country of Ayn Rand's, which I agree with you has never been real, but the truth of the matter is, as long as there's, you know, funding available, any idea can seem like it has public presence and credibility. If there's, you know, some weird rich people that are, you know, ready to dump a lot of money behind it. So, but it feels like by the 80s, we get to that fully weaponized point. Like in Nixon, there's a transition of like, let's do racism and social division. But also, I think guys like Phillips seem to actually want to preserve some version of the New Deal. And then by the 80s, we're going into even deeper, not only racism, you know, even more enhanced racism than Nixon, arguably. And then we're getting into full laissez-faire trickle-down mythology. So how does that happen? When does the trickle-down fantasy start? Because it isn't just, in my view, it isn't just that those tax revolts are happening and then Washington's interpreting them. They're wanting to interpret them in a certain way. So that by,
I think that is exactly right. I mean, I would say they were paid to interpret them in a certain way.
Exactly.
As to your interpretation of Nixon, I think you're spot on in the sense that, you know, the policy legacy of that administration is nothing like what we would consider today to be the Koch brothers' list of legislative fantasies. what I think needs to be understood about him and his politics was that he focused single-mindedly on driving this enormous wedge into the New Deal coalition and breaking it apart, and he was singularly successful in that. In order to do it, in his day, he felt that it was not the time for doctrinaire right-wing policy across the board. That is to say, in order to split the white working class vote, if you want to call it that, from the Democratic Party, you had to make them think they were getting what it was that they liked about the New Deal, which is to say social democracy for white people.
Right.
And so Nixon was not terribly doctrinaire when it came to right-wing dogma. Certainly if you were to he wasn't like a latter-day Robert Taft or any of the sort of people in the Republican Party who had kind of held up the banner of right-wing opposition to the New Deal right through from the late 30s to the 1960s. He wasn't in that mold. I mean, I would say he was in no mold ideologically,
right.
But politically he had the instinct that here was the opportunity. The civil rights movement had created the opportunity to break apart the Democratic coalition, and he would throw everything he had at that political imperative. As to how we get from there to Reagan, what I would say the further development of Republican ideology in a more doctrinaire right-wing direction, I think that, again, as you say, has a lot to do with the kind of billionaire funder interests who created a real political machine behind their vision of what the right-wing politics was supposed to accomplish in this country. So they really saw that they had been, defeated in a grand battle by Roosevelt and by the New Deal, and it was time to kind of get back into the field and undo it. But they never did it in any kind of wholly electoral way the way that Roosevelt did. I mean, I think this is a sort of fundamental asymmetry in politics between right and left that the left needs democracy to get what it wants. There is no other way.
Right.
The right can do with democracy or can do without democracy. I mean, sometimes they can get what they want in democratic context, but they are also very happy to get what they want without it. And I think what we have seen in the ideological evolution of this country kind of shows the full strength of what you can do, just by virtue of this kind of movement operating behind the scenes. Now, to that, I would add one enormous proviso, which kind of gets back to Mandelson. I think a crucial element in the success of the right in this country has been what you might call the capitulation, the ideological capitulation of the left.
Right.
That is to say, Reagan would have been an ideological administration that would have been rolled back had it not ended at the same time as the Cold War ended, and had the left not kind of taken a what I would consider an ultimately self-defeating lesson from that, which is to say that we need to move to the right in order to be politically viable at all. And I think a big part of the move to the right in economics, in economic policy, was the elevation of what I would consider technocratic interests within the broad democratic or left-aligned coalition.
Right.
That is to say, we will turn economic policy over to the credentialed economists,
right.
and they know how to do things. The sort of more populistic, more activist-based economic policy that we ran, say, for instance, in the Great Society and the War on Poverty, has proven to have failed. So we can't do any better than letting the economists run things, and that ultimately radically circumscribes the kind of politics that you can engage in on the left. And that is, in fact, the direct point of my Jacobin piece about tax policy.
Right. And just to touch on briefly, really quickly, we'll go through Bush and Clinton and maybe briefly Obama. But I think that there's an enormous danger, and I think a new opportunity now that's reflected in your piece that we'll get to in a couple of minutes. But so, yeah, in the Clinton era, Clinton actually does pass a sort of slightly progressive tax package in the beginning of his administration. There's some slight modest increases on the rich, but that's also in conjunction with pushing through NAFTA. It's also framed as, there's a bit of a stimulus, but there's this obsession with deficit cutting and all of macroeconomic policy. There's no labor people at the center of it. It's all handed over to Wall Street people. And by the end of the 1990s, I mean, you had you did have these bubbles and this kind of broader growth generally, and Clinton was willing to fiddle around with the tax code here and there and do these kind of micro redistributions. But the overall picture was, whether it be through massive deregulation of Wall Street, tech bubbles, you know, and sort of incentivizing that top-end growth, that obviously inequality grew and the kind of spoils of that growth period were both not sustainable because they were built on a lot of speculation and bubbles, and also not distributed broadly enough across the population. And then in George W. Bush passes this massive package of, you know, sort of takes this kind of bazooka to income to inequality and to entrenching American oligarchy. And then under Obama, we have this sort of same, you know, we get rescued slightly from a massive economic crisis that's, of course, created by all the Wall Street deregulation and Wall Street's, you know, misbehavior and criminality. And then Obama saves it, does a slight stimulus, but then, you know, essentially kind of back to third way economics, just in the context of a post-crisis and with even less kind of broader cultural or economic cushioning for a broad base of America. Before we get to Trump, I mean, is that kind of summary? Do you sort of buy that kind of read of Clinton, Bush, Obama?
Yeah, I definitely buy the broad narrative, and I would highlight two points that I think you touched on. One is the obsession with deficits and the national debt as being a top national priority. To my mind, that was kind of trauma of the right accusing the Democrats of having been tax and spend or just spend liberals, and so they wanted, and so the political strategy on the part of the Democrats was that the best inoculation against that supposedly devastating political attack was to show that no, we are the great stewards of the national budget. Mm-hmm. We can be trusted in order to, and we won't run up the debt. We won't run up the nation's credit card. We'll run the government like you would run your family, that sort of rhetoric. All of that was a gigantic shell game on the part of the right. My view was that their attacks on the tax and spend Democrats was really a veiled racial attack.
Yep.
That is to say, we have you know, the sort of conflation of black people exercising power with enormous government budgets and out of control spending is of long standing in American political history. That is a huge, huge part of the anti-Reconstruction rhetoric that had great currency in the North during the 1860s and 1870s. But the sort of powers that be in the Democratic Party kind of interpreted it way too narrowly and thought, well, they're saying that we run up the deficit, so let's show the country that we don't run up the deficit.
Right.
And that, of course, exerts a great discipline on what you can actually do when you're in power. But more kind of relevantly to this conversation, it didn't actually solve the political problem. It was a misreading of what the political attack really was and what could possibly have blunted it and turned it back. And yet you got, you know, a great deal of deference paid to the imperative of not increasing the debt too much in both the Clinton and the Obama presidency. And then the other thing I would point to is specifically the erosion of effective taxes on capital.
Mm-hmm.
Now the piece, the Jacobin piece talks in general about progressive taxation, but the idea of taxing capital or the income that capital generates is a more specific issue. Now, of course, it's rich people who own things. So anytime you're talking about taxes on capital, you're talking about progressive taxation. But I think you can see in the decisions that were made, certainly in the Clinton administration, and even to a degree in the Obama administration, you can see essentially the Democratic economic policymakers buying into the orthodox economic assumption that taxing capital is bad for the economy. So even as you had statutory increases in the top marginal tax rate under Clinton, you also had the easing up of regulations about which kinds of corporations could classify themselves as pass-through entities for tax purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And My political interpretation of that was and is that there is a consensus among elite tax officials and policymakers that there should be no taxes on capital or corporate profits. But you can't actually pass that through the floor of Congress, because saying we're going to eliminate the corporate tax system, or saying that we're going to eliminate taxes on shareholders, is obviously going to be politically unpopular. My view would be for good reason, but this consensus would hold that reflects, misguided populist beliefs about the economy. So if you can't do that, then the next best thing is to just gut the corporate tax system from the inside using administrative rather than political procedures. All of us who know what we're talking about know that we shouldn't really be taxing these people anyway, so let's just let them get out of paying taxes.
Right.
And I don't think that the Clinton administration's tax policy was, a gigantic conspiracy, and nor was it united behind that particular ideology. I think you could definitely say the Republican administrations have been, and indeed, I would go so far as to say that in international tax negotiations, there have been instances in which officials representing the Treasury of the United States have essentially acceded to the avoidance of the United States corporate profits tax, which is an international tax. So in theory, all U.S. corporations are taxed based on profits, no matter where they're earned. In practice, U.S. Treasury officials, who should be basically trying to collect money on behalf of the United States taxpayer, turned a blind eye to this under the ideology that we should not be this tax should not exist, so therefore we will not really enforce it and turn a blind eye as multinational corporations avoid it.
Right.
I would say, to get to the Obama administration, I think that has waned. You could say that this wasn't really the administration's decision as so much as derived from the endless back and forth with Congress. But when we finally got to the summer of 2011, when there was all this grand bargain negotiations, and then finally the end of 2012, I think, was the fiscal cliff and the negotiations around that. The ultimate upshot was that the Bush administration's tax cuts were extended indefinitely for all but people earning over some amount, like $250,000
a year. Yeah, I think it was the top 2% of earners.
Right. But what was extended indefinitely was their dividend tax cut of 2003.
Right.
And as I was saying, anytime you're talking about capital income tax cuts, you're talking about tax cuts for the rich. But this rhetoric that, taxing capital income is bad for the economy, nonetheless survived well enough that it's still in place in statute.
Right. So a very interesting, obviously, a lot of interesting things happened in 2016. And we had a sort of best of times, worst of times. And unfortunately, the worst of times has continued. We have this, this really disgusting guy as president. But the sort of from a political perspective, obviously, we had Bernie Sanders, making the actual case for why we need national systems of delivery, and why essentially, yes, we need to have massive progressive taxation to fund these things in sort of a kind of basic, obvious, muscular case for social democracy. And that, certainly caught fire, obviously, particularly with young people. And then Donald Trump, and this is where it seems to me we're at we're at an enormously dangerous point, right? Because Republicans control all the levers of power, and because people like, the Koch brothers, it's like they really are, so they're just, zombies for their tax, giveaways. And that's all they care about, and every other kind of metric of public well-being is obviously irrelevant for them in terms of their just sort of endless quest to give themselves more things. But Donald Trump, and this is where we can make, I think, those neo-Nixonian arguments, or call him like a dumb Nixon, credible, because, he fused together robust, racism, misogyny, xenophobia. We know that. He leveraged that. He stopped speaking in subtext like other Republicans, and he kind of did the robust white identity politics that drives the Republican base. And then he fused it with an actual, at times, you know, not specific, but kind of general and atmospherically honest appraisal of things like the behavior of Wall Street. He promised not to touch Medicare and Social Security. He promised not to have, you know, top-end loaded tax giveaways like Republicans usually propose. And, you know, what's interesting is that even now as president, obviously he's, you know, fusing his racism with basically just an attempt along with Congress to do a Koch brothers and other, you know, corporate giveaway agenda. But he still has an instinct to at least lie about this. And before we get to the question, I do want to play this clip of him talking with Maria Bartiromo. I think this was over the weekend. And, you know, it's funny because he's incoherent, but there is an actual point here about how he's still trying to sell what his tax package is going to be. Now, in fairness, only a framework has been released, which they're saying is not going to be less progressive than what exists. But, you know, by all indications, and especially with what is in Congress and Mnuchin and Mulvaney, of course, this is going to be another enormous regressive giveaway. But here's Trump.
But see, that's what I don't understand, and I followed your policies really closely. The state and local income tax deduction elimination, you take that away, and then you go to a fifth bracket or a fourth bracket, however you want to say it, and you get a higher rate for the top earners.
Right.
If the top earners pay 80% of the taxes, why are you so afraid to cut taxes on the top earners?
I think this, look, you know, I am very happy with the way I've done prior to this in my civilian life, all right?
This is not about
other
you.
People. Well, it's about me representing rich people. Let's say representing, you know, being representative of rich people. It's very interesting to me. Bob Kraft was down. He was very nice. He owns the Patriots. He gave me a Super Bowl ring a month ago.
And
he
left. And shook his,
right? Which was very nice. Yeah, that's right. But he left this beautiful ring, and I immediately give it to the White House, and they put it someplace, and that's the way it is. But he said to me, he's a good man, he said to me, you have to do us all a favor. Give the tax decrease to the middle class. We don't need it. We don't need it. We don't want it. Give it to the middle class.
So there you have it. He's still framing this, even though obviously the agenda is to have a massive giveaway. But I think what this reveals as an opportunity, and where your piece comes in, is that at the very least now, and especially, and this is still incumbent upon the, you know, the Democrats or the broader center left to actual left, to once and for all really get that taxes are a political issue. They're not a technocratic one. They're not a managerial one. It's a decision about what society we have. And the fact that Donald Trump is still doing this, and the fact that there's at least a need to pretend on some level, maybe at least needs that means that the ideological blinders are coming off to some degree generally, and there's an opportunity to seize that moment and say, we need to tax the top end, not because it's moral or even because of a kind of vague Keynesian case, but because this is the only way we're going to basically have a functioning democracy with universal benefits that match the needs of our time.
I would go further than that. Yeah. I think it's the only way that we're going to have a functioning economy that actually serves up a decent standard of living. And I think that in part because of the programs that progressive taxation can finance. But I think moreover, it's about deconcentrating power in the economy. And a huge swath of our economic problems are due to the concentration of power both across firms, that is to say the biggest and most powerful firms taking market share and taking customers and profits from less powerful competitors, and within firms, that is to say shareholders and executives being able to run these enormously powerful firms how they see fit, which is to say getting as much money to the top as possible. And the crucial thing that progressive taxation can do is that it can redistribute power in the economy. And this is what I think has been missing from the center left's tax ideology, insofar as it has one, is that there's a few elements of it. Among them, the, you know, we need to make sure that the government has enough money and it doesn't run a deficit. There's the we need to pay for programs that benefit you and your family, like Medicare and Medicaid. That's certainly true. But there has been this unwillingness to take on what the Republicans intuitively understand, which is to say that taxes fundamentally shape how the economy works. Mm-hmm. The Republicans just have to be completely wrong about how they do that. It's not about cutting taxes so that rich people have the incentive to invest and that trickles down to everybody else. It's about raising taxes so the rich people don't have an incentive to steal from the rest of us. Right. And this was a crucial part of Roosevelt's economic ideology, and he didn't create it himself. It was a long tradition in the progressive and populist movements that led up to the New Deal. And it is something that, to my view, the contemporary left has forgotten, and forgotten in different ways. There's there's a tax ideology kind of in the center. There's a tax ideology on the left that has to do with paying for universal programs. Mm-hmm. And it's not that any of those are false, but that this crucial other element, the element that sits on top of it all about what the form, what the function of taxes is, are in the economy and in the society, that has been totally forgotten. And I think that is something that the Republicans and that clip of Donald Trump reveals that they understand, and that we have just been totally blind to and unwilling to confront.
And as a final question, I mean, and that adds a whole other, like, even these moments when, you know, say, like, you know, because obviously there's no, I mean, Bernie Sanders is not making the full case that you're making, but I mean, he's, you know, obviously sort of somebody in contemporary politics, he's at least making the universal programs case, which is just the beginning. But this notion that, you know, even when you get a question from some, you know, one of those idiots at a CNN town hall is like, I'm a small business owner, you know, like, maybe so, right? And I don't think I should have a tax cut, or I think everybody deserves a tax cut, or this kind of, like, you know, that sort of typical cliche. And the response is always, well, you know, as you say, it's either like the Obama-Clinton, got to pay for things, got to pay for things, got to be responsible. Or even the kind of like, I don't think morally the Koch brothers deserve a tax cut right now, or the Mercers deserve a tax giveaway right now. The next step is that, right, well, actually, this is just about power, and I'm interested in designing an economy so that these weird families can't steal more money from us and there's more jobs for you. What do you think of that?
Yeah, that is exactly what I think. Right. I mean, I think that's it's a great message, and it has the advantage of actually being what people already think. I mean, I think right. When Trump made that comment to Maria Bartiromo, I'm guessing he had some political advice that said that this is what the people want to hear. And I can tell you, at least in that respect, he's absolutely right. You know, I think if you ask people what their top priority is in tax policy, it is that the wealthy and powerful corporations should have to pay their fair share, because everyone intuitively gets that the way the economy is set up now, these powerful entities are able to wriggle out of their obligations and they fall on the rest of us. Right. And that ultimately has a decisive effect on what their incentives are in terms of running the economy, either to the broad public benefit or to their own private benefit. So I think really the politics of this could not be more clear cut. And I hope that, you know, everyone from Senator Sanders to, you know, the biggest deficit hawk or whatever in the Democratic Party will take heed of, you know, where the politics of progressive taxation really are in this day and age.
It's about power. Marshall Steinbaum of the Roosevelt Institute, I really, really appreciate your time. We have a link to all of the ways that people can find you, as well as your article on the tax debate we need in the Jacobin. This is really important stuff. It's very well done. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
All right, everybody. We are going to go to the fun half, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Give us a review on iTunes, justcoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. The IMs should be on 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. A bunch of sound and all that good stuff in the fun half. Later.